In our hyper-productive world, Joseph Pieper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture, arrives like a revolutionary manifesto. Written in post-war Germany, 1947, this philosophical gem challenges our modern obsession with constant activity and what Pieper calls total work. Imagine a world where your worth isn't measured by your output, where contemplation isn't considered laziness, and where simply being human is enough. This isn't some utopian fantasy, it's the foundation upon which Western civilization was built. The very word school comes from the Greek skole, meaning leisure. For the ancients, leisure wasn't Netflix binges or weekend getaways, it was the foundation of education, contemplation, and culture itself. Aristotle would be shocked by our modern mantra that one lives to work. We've completely inverted the relationship, making leisure merely a tool to enhance productivity rather than seeing work as something we do to enable leisure. This fundamental shift has profound implications for how we structure our lives, educate our children, and understand what it means to flourish as humans. What makes our predicament particularly troubling is how work has colonized domains once considered sacred. When was the last time you did something with absolutely no practical purpose? Even our free time is increasingly structured, scheduled, and oriented towards self-improvement or future utility. Medieval thinkers distinguished between ratio, logical thought, and intellectus, intuitive vision. Ratio involves analytical problem-solving, while intellectus is receptive and contemplative, like analyzing a painting stroke by stroke versus stepping back to absorb its overall beauty. The modern belief that knowledge is work suggests knowledge comes only through effort, creating the tense countenance of the intellectual worker. As Grupa observed, this constant activity often ends in bankruptcy. Yet our greatest insights frequently emerge during relaxation, in the shower, on walks, or before sleep. Our fixation on difficulty as a measure of value makes us suspicious of what comes easily. But Thomas Aquinas reminded us, the essence of virtue consists in the good rather than in the difficult. We admire pianists not for their strain, but for the effortless beauty they produce after years of practice. True understanding requires both active effort and receptive openness, with many valuable insights coming not through forceful striving, but through patient attention to truth. Leisure stands in complete opposition to the worker ideal in three fundamental ways. First, leisure implies non-activity and inward calm, not being busy, but letting things happen. It requires silence, not mere noiselessness, but the soul's receptive power to answer reality undisturbed. Unlike the restless activity that characterizes the modern mind, leisure allows things to unfold naturally, similar to falling asleep, which requires letting oneself go. Second, leisure is an attitude of contemplative celebration. It draws vitality from affirmation, consenting to one's true nature and abiding in concord with the universe's meaning. Like lovers' tranquil silence drawing strength from concord, leisure celebrates the basic meaningfulness of existence. Just as God beheld creation and saw it was very good, in leisure we affirm it is good. Third, leisure stands perpendicular to work as social function. Unlike breaks taken for work's sake, leisure exists on a different plane entirely. It cuts across work vertically, as intellectus relates to eternity, while ratio relates to time. Leisure doesn't exist to restore working powers, though it does renew strength, but to ensure the functionary remains fully human, capable of grasping the world as a whole. What does it mean to be a proletarian today? It's not about income. Some of the wealthiest people are thoroughly proletarianized. A proletarian is someone fettered to the process of work, whose identity is consumed by their economic function. This fettering stems from three causes: lack of property, dependence on selling labor, external coercion, systemic pressures forcing participation, and inner impoverishment, inability to imagine life beyond work. Consider how often people's first question when meeting someone is, "What do you do?" as if occupation defines identity. This mindset pervades society. Doctors working 80-hour weeks, lawyers billing endless hours, and tech workers living at their offices all embody this condition. Even leisure becomes productivity-oriented. Meditation for focus, exercise for energy, vacations to prevent burnout. Deproletarianization requires expanding life beyond merely useful work through employee ownership, protected time for contemplation, and communities valuing non-productive activities. Our worth extends beyond economic output. When asked, "What do you do?" perhaps the most revolutionary answer is, "I am human. I exist." Isn't that enough? Leisure's essence lies in celebration, the union of relaxation, effortlessness, and engagement. If celebration forms leisure's core, then leisure can only be justified on the same basis as a festival, divine worship. Divine worship relates to time as temples relate to space. Temples are ground reserved from utilitarian use and given to the gods. Similarly, divine worship sets aside time from working hours. Every seventh day embodies such festival time. In the world of total labor, no space remains unused, no time withdrawn from utility. The worker's world exists solely on rational utilization. A feast day becomes merely a work break or a celebration of work itself. Entertainment exists, but can mass entertainment truly be called festive? The world of work remains impoverished despite material goods because genuine wealth, which implies overflowing into superfluities, cannot exist on a utilitarian basis. Divine worship creates real wealth through sacrifice, its living heart. Sacrifice, a voluntary offering freely given, stands antithetical to utility, creating wealth that the workaday world cannot consume. To philosophize means stepping out of the workaday world, the realm of useful functions, demand and supply, hunger and satiety. This world focuses on satisfying common need through work, which differs fundamentally from the common good. The common good encompasses what Aquinas called the useless life of contemplation, art, music, literature, philosophical inquiry. Philosophy's freedom lies in its uselessness. It represents what Newman called the knowledge of a gentleman, knowledge pursued for its own sake. This is the meaning of liberal in liberal arts, disciplines cultivating mind and spirit rather than satisfying practical needs. Unlike sciences, philosophy cannot serve external ends. Governments might reasonably say, "We need physicists," but cannot demand we need philosophers to elaborate this ideology without strangling philosophy itself. Philosophy contains its own end and cannot be instrumentalized without losing its essential nature. This liberation from immediate utility allows philosophy to examine fundamental questions about existence, knowledge, ethics, and reality, questions that seem impractical yet are essential to human understanding. Wonder, that profound, receptive astonishment at existence, marks the true beginning of philosophy. It acknowledges our incomplete knowledge while driving us to seek understanding. Unlike animals confined to their environments, humans possess spirit, the capacity to form relationships with the totality of being. We are finite spirit, a blend of plant, animal, and spiritual life, requiring familiarity, yet capable of transcendence. The truly human condition is seeing stars above the roof, maintaining universality amid daily routines. Philosophizing means experiencing how our immediate surroundings can be interrupted by the call of the world. In a society valuing only measurement and utility, the greatest rebellion might be simply to wonder, to stand in awe before existence. our salvation lies not in more work, but in reclaiming the contemplative dimension that makes us fully human, the capacity to behold the world with reverence.